Indigenous cultures have been trying to protect plant medicines and the sacred ceremonies around them for centuries. And as Michael Pollan, the author of How to Change Your Mind, says, people have known about the power of magic mushrooms a long, long time.
Probably millennia. I mean, the first reports we have, this isn't a written culture, but when the conquistadors get to Central America, they find people using mushrooms in their religious ceremonies as a sacrament. And they called it Teonatecatl, which is meant flesh of the gods. And that's, of course, what the Christians called their sacrament too, right? It was the flesh of God that you're eating in the communion. So this was very threatening to the Catholic Church because here was a sacrament that actually really worked. I mean, you didn't need faith to see God. You met God.
Or as the ethnobotanist Dennis McKenna puts it,
it carries a much bigger kick than the Catholic Eucharist. So Catholicism and Christianity brutally suppressed all of these shamanic practices. They were particularly brutal with the mushrooms.
And they crushed it. They absolutely banned it. They destroyed mushroom stones. They tortured people who practiced it.
Mushroom stones. So they were actually like little statues in the shape of mushrooms?
Little statues, and some of them pretty big, but they are stones carved in the shape of mushrooms. There have been many theories about what they're for. They're found all over Guatemala and southern Mexico.
Some of these miniature mushroom stones in Guatemala, they go back to 3000 BC, which is pretty far back.
And now they turn up in farmers' fields occasionally because people buried them. They were afraid to be caught with them. So the mushroom cults, as they were called, and of course we call a religion a cult when we don't like it, went underground and was thought to have disappeared until the middle of the 20th century.
Rumors started swirling around that the mushroom was still used in sacred ceremonies in Mexico. And that's when magic mushrooms came roaring back, thanks to one man.
There we found that rotten bagasse covered with mushrooms. They were the sacred mushrooms.
Gordon Wasson.
That's right.
Who would seem to be the most unlikely person to turn psychedelic mushrooms into a mainstream phenomenon. I mean, he was a vice president.
He was a banker. Yeah.
At J.P. Morgan.
He was very plugged in New York. He marries a Russian woman, a pediatrician.
Valentina Wasson, who was obsessed with mushrooms.
Anyway, the story goes that on their honeymoon, they went up to the Catskills, and they're walking in the woods, and she starts finding all these mushrooms, and she starts collecting them in her skirt and makes this big pile of mushrooms, and she proposes to cook them for dinner. He absolutely refuses to eat them. She eats them. He thinks he's going to wake up a widower the next morning. But lo and behold, she knew what she was doing. And this got him very interested in mushrooms.
So in his spare time, Wasson developed a lifelong obsession with mushrooms, especially the psychedelic ones. He studied how they influenced human cultures around the world and came up with a theory that the origin of religion was actually rooted in people's transcendent experiences on magic mushrooms.
And if you think about it, where do these interesting, bizarre ideas at the heart of many religions come from? That there is a beyond, that there's an unseen world, that there is a realm of the dead that you could visit, that there is a heaven and hell. I mean, these are interesting ideas, and you could see why having a psychedelic journey would convince you of their truth. And he heard about these mushroom cults in Central America, and he went looking in Mexico.
For years, didn't he? Multiple trips down there.
I think he had like 11 trips down there.
Looking for someone who would take him in so he could participate in a mushroom ceremony.
Yeah, and given the secrecy that surrounded it, earning someone's trust so they would actually say, yes, we do use mushrooms this way, and yes, I will administer some to you. But he finds a woman, a curandera or a healer named Maria Sabina in the town of Huatla de Jimenez, which is a couple days by mule outside of Oaxaca in the very remote mountains. And she gives him the mushrooms, what she calls the little children. And he has this experience in the basement of this house. And he brings a photographer and he recounts this experience in the pages of Life magazine in a like 17-page article. The reason he gets it into Life magazine is that he's friendly with Henry Luce,
the publisher.
And Henry Luce, as it turns out, is a giant fan of psychedelics. He's had psychedelic therapy. I know, it's the weirdest history.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely fascinating.
But you have to remember, all this is legal, right? This is 1955. He has his experience. In 56 or 57, he publishes the article. And this article really introduces much of the West to psychedelic mushrooms and psychedelic experience in general. So Gordon Wasson is really a pivotal figure in this history.
But what about the other pivotal figure, Maria Sabina? Wasson gets the credit for jumpstarting the psychedelic revolution, but it never would have happened without the Mazatec curandero who took him on this journey. The consequences for her were pretty awful, and a notorious example of how so much can go so wrong when white people go into indigenous cultures they don't really understand.
I think there's even a risk of sort of romanticizing this indigenous set of practices. We can't just isolate this ceremony or this set of experiences and say, you know, how sacred and wonderful this is, and we're just going to ignore all of these other features. In some ways, that's the story that exists around Maria Sabina, this woman who freely shared wisdom about psilocybin and died penniless and rather ostracized from her community.
Erica Dick is a historian at the University of Saskatchewan who's written widely on the history of psychedelics.
She introduced Wasson and Valentina, his wife, to these practices, and it brought about this sort of stunning revelation of the power of these plant teachers or these plant medicines. But the story is kind of tragic. Gordon Wasson goes on and publishes a number of things, many very nuanced, thoughtful ways that he reflected upon this encounter and the many he had since then. Maria Sabina lived into her 90s, and the stories locally are that she was ostracized from her community, that the Life magazine and subsequent publications drew a lot of attention to this rather impoverished indigenous community.
Because suddenly it became a place where all of these Americans and Europeans wanted to go to have their own psychedelic experiences, and they went to her to get the substances.
Absolutely. These pilgrimages to Oaxaca to meet Maria Sabina or be in the presence of where she grew up.
The story of Gordon Wasson's visit to Maria Sabina is even more tangled and ethically problematic. For one thing, he wasn't alone. Apparently, the CIA knew about the trip and followed the Wassons down to Sabina's village, hoping to discover drugs that could be used as weapons for mind control. And the Wassons themselves lied to Sabina, who had said from the beginning that she did not want any publicity, let alone fame.
They had promised to keep her anonymous. They published her name as Eva Mendez originally. But they also published her face in one of the biggest magazines at the time that every American would see.
This is Life magazine.
Life magazine. And then shortly thereafter revealed her real name and where she could be found.
Catherine McLean is a psychologist and former psychedelic guide who's been digging into the history about Maria Sabina. After Sabina was outed in Life magazine, psychedelic tourists began flooding into her village, and the results were disastrous. Her neighbors grew resentful. Her house was burned down. She was accused of selling drugs and even briefly jailed.
I knew about that part, but I didn't know that they had lied to her to get the mushrooms in the first place. So they went down there and they spoke to an official in the town, and they said, "Who's the best mushroom healer here? We're searching for this mushroom. You know, we're just curious." And the government official was the one who went to seek out Maria Sabina because she was the best. And it was a special holy day where you're not supposed to turn anyone away if they seek your healing. Think about it. The mayor of your town, you're a poor woman, you're a single woman, you're taking care of all your kids and your mother, your aging mother. So she says, "Okay, I guess I'll do this one time." So there was a whole kind of ruse going on around what would it take a true expert to agree to do this if the knowledge is hidden and they don't want to share it. So yeah. There was kind of a lot of strategy that was used to convince A true, she was an expert to reveal her secrets.
Catherine McLean worked on some of the early psychedelic research at Johns Hopkins. And for her, Maria Sabina is a personal touchstone, a woman who has been largely left out of psychedelic history.
If you look back in history, there aren't many women who stand out as historical figures, especially in science, and especially not many indigenous women, women with brown skin, women who might have been anonymous to the scientific world other than happened to be maybe at the wrong place or the right place at the right time. It wasn't until after I left my job at Johns Hopkins that I realized that Maria Sabina was a bit of a patron saint of mushrooms and potentially part of my own lineage. Yeah, I think if I could pick anybody in psilocybin, she would be it. You know, she had the direct ticket to whatever this mystery is that we still don't understand.
So she talked about the mushrooms speaking through her.
She did.
What do you think she meant?
Well, so if you go back and look at how she described it, she described receiving a visionary holy book. She called it the Book of Knowledge or the Book of Wisdom. And she believed that these divine beings, saints, had given it to her. She memorized the whole thing in one night, she says, and that that was what allowed her to sing and determine what could heal someone. And so interestingly, I think some people experience mushroom visions visually, and other people experience these words or sounds. I've experienced both, but strikingly, there was an experience I had once where I heard actual words like prayers, poetry coming from the mushroom. And then when I looked it up later, it was actual scripture. So I kind of wonder, like, maybe she wasn't being metaphorical. Maybe she experienced scripture coming from a divine source that she just interpreted as she needed to. The interesting thing about Maria Sabina is that she grew up very poor. She describes being hungry almost her entire childhood. And she and her sister started eating the magic mushrooms out of hunger. And she knew they were safe because she had seen her relatives eating them and using them to heal people. So the healing gift skipped over her father, but her great-grandfather, her grandfather, she had a great aunt, she had many family members who had the gift.
The gift being what?
My understanding is that the gift was the ability to receive the mushroom wisdom and speak, communicate, connect with the mushrooms in a way that this divine source would tell her what was wrong with someone.
Santo, 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 cho San Pedro, ya que tia nyanga, senti San Pedro, ya que tia nyanga tito.
And what she described is that before Gordon came, we would use the mushrooms for true healing. You know, if someone was really desperate and there was something that even the doctors couldn't figure out, the kind of the lower tier healers couldn't figure out, you go to a wise person, which was Maria Sabina and others. And she said, after all the white people came down, she said they were just seeking God. They just wanted this fast track experience. And it was no longer about kind of humbling yourself, asking for help, and really submitting to the process. You know, it was kind of this ego trip.
And didn't she say that once these white hippies came down, that that portal to God had closed?
So she said a couple things. One is she said that that portal closed. It would no longer work the same way it had worked. And I also know that healers, like Maria Sabina, have said, we only tell you white people 10% of what's actually happening because we don't want you to know the 90%. So who knows why she said those things? You know, maybe she realized the cat's out of the bag. They don't even know what they're doing yet. So we better just, oh, it doesn't work anymore. Go away. You know, let us kind of go back to our practice.
And it's striking that she had become the object of all these pilgrimages. People wanted to have these experiences with her. But she remained poor to the end of her life. She did not get rich out of this.
No, absolutely not. And if you ask even practicing healers now, they can't accept money. They might accept like a token gift or a barter, an exchange. But no, she didn't get paid for these experiences that people were getting. I've heard some folks on social media say that they figured out how much she was paid by Gordon Wasson based on today's standards, and it was $10 or $11. So for $10, we got psilocybin, which represents hundreds, if not thousands, of years of trial and error and practice and people being born with the talent and passing it along. And so I think we have to remember that Maria Sabina was the end of a lineage that went back beyond the Spanish arriving in the New World, who knows how long. And so what she was teaching us, even if it was 10%, represents real wisdom that we're just still figuring this out.
When you think back on the story of Maria Sabina, is this a tragic story to you?
I think it is a tragic story. My best sense of it is that Maria Sabina understood that it was partly fate or destiny that kind of brought her into this world. And at the same time, her life was kind of ruined. It's difficult for me because on the one hand, I feel connected to this woman, and I wouldn't even know she had existed if not for all of these levels of deception and theft. You know, these are kind of extreme words, but if not for all of the things that contributed to her giving the mushrooms to this one person, I wouldn't have benefited. I wouldn't have been able to study psilocybin. I wouldn't have benefited from mushrooms. I mean, maybe I would have found them another way. And so I kind of hold it in both hands. Most of what I have received as a white American is a result of lots of criminal and violent activity before I was born. So I think it's more a matter of just accepting that we can't go back and change the past, but we can say her name, we can honor her, and, you know, maybe the companies now can give back to the people who are still practicing.
For both Catherine McLean and Erica Dick, that's the real point of this story. It's not just the history of one woman and how she suffered. It's about the unintended or unthinking exploitation of one culture by another. The hippies who made the trek to Maria Sabina's village didn't mean to do any damage. They just wanted a mind-blowing experience and were willing to ignore the socioeconomic inequities to get it.
And there's this kind of superficial vow of poverty, even as the hippies took on this bohemian lifestyle and they were going to really slum it and go to Mexico and pretend to be poor for a little while. But it sort of undermines and even perhaps mocks the state of poverty amongst indigenous people that was perpetuated by those pilgrimages, if you will.
Why would that be perpetuated? You would think that if these wealthy white people came to Oaxaca, that they would spend money in the local communities. Why was that impoverishing?
I think, you know, some anthropologists have drawn attention to the way that people sort of left the worldly possessions behind and went to Oaxaca in search of spiritual enlightenment and didn't come there and give money or stay at a hotel or contribute to the local economy in any meaningful way. And so there was, again, a kind of succession of taking and a degradation to the existing fragile economy. And I think we need to be really, really mindful of stories like this that are potentially cautionary tales for, you know, perpetuating those colonial ideas even when the intention is not there.
That's historian Erica Dick and Catherine McLean, author of the memoir Midnight Water. We also heard from Michael Pollan and Dennis McKenna. I'm Steve Paulson.